Race of My Life, presented by Autosport.
I always thought the ring was the greatest circuit, and even to do well there gave me more pleasure than winning on some others. I was confident of doing well in the race, but although I was 4 seconds faster than Stirling Moss in practice, I was not there to try and beat him unless, for some reason, he was unable to go fast enough to win. This may sound odd today, but I had been brought up to believe in team sports at school. As I was number two to Moss, he was entitled to the best car, and my job was to back him up and try to win if he was unable to. These are the words of six-time Formula One race winner Tony Brooks, describing his early thoughts on the events at the 1958 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring, which he won and later selected as his race of my life to Autosport in 1993. This pick, which had many similarities to the great Juan Manuel Fangio's win at the 1957 German Grand Prix at the same venue, is the latest in our Race of My Life miniseries. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas, Autosport's Grand Prix editor, and with me today are two guests. The first is one of the UK's leading commentators, Ian Titchmarsh. Ian, how are you? Welcome back to the Race of My Life podcast.
Pretty good, thanks, Alex. Yes, hello to you and hello to Kevin. Looking forward to this.
Absolutely. There you go. We've got Kevin Turner, Autosport's chief editor, with us as well. Kev, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Yeah, the sun is shining, although obviously if you're listening to the podcast in a couple of weeks and it's raining, I'll apologise. But at this particular moment, I can see blue sky and I'm looking at a picture of a 1958 Vauxhall, so I'm very happy.
Yeah, that sounds like your ideal dream, I think. well, Ian, perhaps you can give us a little bit of background to the 1958 German Grand Prix. What would sort of gone on that year in the World Championship so far?
Well, we had a curious start to the 1958 season in that Van Wall, for whom Stirling Moss and Tony Brooks were going to be driving that year, along with Stuart Lewis Evans, hadn't been able to make it, develop their engines for the new fuel regulations in time for the Argentinian Grand Prix. So Stirling Moss had gone out there and won that in a remarkable performance in the little Cooper, 2-litre Cooper engine, when it was 2.5-litre engine capacity, that was the maximum. So he'd won that. He'd had misfortunes at Spa, where Tony Brooks had won fortuitously because his gearbox was about to break on the last lap, so he took the flag. And so the World Championship was fluctuating between Stirling Moss, Tony Brooks and Mike Hawthorne in the Ferrari, who won the French Grand Prix, the only Grand Prix that he won that year. Stirling Moss was winning in the Cooper, then he won elsewhere as well. They actually arrived at Silverstone for the British Grand Prix, the race before the German Grand Prix, tied on points. The race was won by Peter Collins. Second in the Ferrari also was Mike Hawthorne. Stirling Moss retired, and so Mike Hawthorne came to the Nürburgring leading the championship. But as Tony Brooks said in that quote you read from him, he saw himself as backing up Stirling Moss in Stirling's bid to win the World Championship. Fangio had retired. In fact, his last race was the French Grand Prix a few weeks earlier. And so it was now who was going to be his successor, because he'd won so many World Championships before 1958. So the scene was set for a real battle between, I put the four of them in, Peter Collins, Mike Hawthorne in the Ferraris, Stirling Moss and Tony Brooks in the Vauxhalls.
And probably worth mentioning as well that Tony had been rather unfortunate before that race in that the only points he'd scored so far up to that point that year was the win in Belgium. So whereas Ian says, Stirling was only 7 points away from Mike. So as well as a kind of obvious team orders or team order within the squad, I think that the points situation also suggested that Moss was Van Wall's sort of main driver, really. And of course he did duly go off into the lead early on before hitting his own problems. And I think one of the features of Tony Brooks's best drives is that he often was able to step up very well when Moss hit trouble. It almost like, right, now it falls upon me. And he pulled out some superb performances.
He did. He qualified second in this race. Hawthorne put it on pole for Ferrari. Then we got Brooks and Moss in third place. So, you know, what was the feeling going into the race, do we think?
Yeah, so I Hawthorne was on pole, as you say. And actually, Tony Brooks sort of did himself a disservice in his Race of My Life because he claimed he was 4 seconds ahead of Moss. It was actually 4.9, but I guess around a 9-minute lap at the Nürburgring. That's, yeah, perhaps splitting hairs slightly. But yeah, so you had Ferrari, Vauxhall, Ferrari in the top five. I think given the previous results, as Ian was talking about earlier, I think you are looking at one of those four British drivers to be the pace setter. I think it's fair to say that Moss would be the one you'd expect to be the lead man. He'd been the guy most likely to take the fight to Fangio in 56 and 57, had beaten him several times towards the second half of 1957. He won that ridiculous race in Argentina with the 2-litre Cooper. So I think you would expect Moss to be the favourite going in, even though he'd qualified third, because I think that qualifying times didn't have quite the same level of importance as they do today, because obviously overtaking was easier. So I think it was a classic Ferrari Van Wall confrontation, really, that was nicely set up by practice.
Yeah, not often that you get you don't get it at all in these days, of course, but one by one grids, but a 4-3-4 grid, and the front row of the grid was the two Ferraris of Mike Hawthorn and Peter Collins, the two Van Wals of Tony Brooks and Sully Moss, the main four contenders, all British drivers. They were the top four drivers of the time.
Yeah, they were really the fighting for that mantle to take over at the top from Fangio, weren't they? As I say, and it was one of those races where Moss took off in the lead, which he did quite often. And Brooks, in his race not lucky, talks about the car. He felt the car was awful on full tanks, and he didn't really want to push it when it felt that bad. And of course, he also makes the point that the car was atrocious at the Nürburgring the year before. They just couldn't get it right, but they'd obviously made a lot of changes and the car was much, much better. But he wasn't happy with the balance of it. He said it was horrible. So he was happy, as he often was, actually, I think, to let Moss and the Ferraris sort of go and do their thing, and then sort of slightly Prost-like, I guess, and sort of work his way into the race a bit later. And as it was, Moss actually only lasted. He led the first three laps, and then he went out. The car let him down. And that left Collins and Hawthorn up front and Brooks quite a long way behind, actually. He lost a lot of time in those early laps with the heavy fuel before he started getting it really wound up.
Yeah, he was. I'm looking this up, actually. 22 seconds he was behind Peter Collins after Moss retired.
Yes, and I don't think he charged forward straight away either. I think he sort of, it was as the fuel load came off and he felt more comfortable, he decided to press on. And interestingly, he obviously took the Race of My Life question. He did his interview back in 1993, but he obviously took that question very seriously because he went away and looked up the amount of time that Fangio had taken out of Collins and Hawthorn in his pursuit in 57. And compared it to his own, how much time he'd taken out the same two drivers the following year. And it actually was a slightly higher number, which I think was I don't think he was being boastful. I think he was trying to put it into context how much of an effort and fine drive it was to get back to them. And of course, it was a shorter race as well.
I'm reading from the nice little book called The German Grand Prix by Cyril Postumus, which is well worth getting. You've probably got it, Kevin, haven't you? But it says, on lap 7, Brooks gained no less than 10 seconds on the two Ferraris. So, and he was lapping, and this is only 1 year on from Fangio's great race, and they were lapping on the first flying lap. Moss broke the lap record that Fangio had set the year before. The chunks of time that were coming off, and he got down to a lap of 9 minutes, 10 seconds, Tony Brooks did, compared with what Fangio had been doing the year before. So it was just, his record was a 9:17, so it was 7 seconds under Fangio's lap record.
Yes, the only difference there, of course, is that Brooks's performance actually wasn't enough to have the new lap record, because Moss had actually gone so fast on lap 3, 9:09.2, that even as the fuel load came off and Brooks was charging after the Ferraris, he didn't actually beat that time, which perhaps gives you a bit of an idea of how quickly Moss was going in those early laps. But yeah, so it then becomes a similar sort of affair to the Fangio chase, I suppose, only for a different reason. It's not a pit stop that's put Brooks down. And of course, the race is shorter. They reduced it from 22 to only 15 for the 1958 race, as the Grand Prix were shorter in 50 for 58. He catches and passes the Ferraris, but sadly, the race doesn't just finish in that way like it did in 57. things took a turn for the worse. You have a bit of a sort of a theory about this, Ian.
Yes, I mean, I think, again, it was Dennis Jenkinson knew these drivers all very well. I mean, he reckons that it was Peter Collins. He was under pressure at Ferrari anyway because he, for example, had been dropped from the French Grand Prix and had to drive in the Formula 2 race at Reims, France. He got back into a Formula 1 car for the British Grand Prix, which he blitzed the field in. I mean, it was an extraordinary performance. He beat Mike Holt on all the Van Walls and everything else at Silverstone. 2 weeks later, ends up at the Nürburgring, but then finds himself battling for the lead. Once Sterling Moss had retired, battling for the lead with his mate, Mike Hawthorn, but they're being caught by the van wall. And Peter Collins is almost a bit like Luigi Musso, who we haven't mentioned previously in this, but Musso was their teammate, and he was under pressure as well, and he crashed fatally at Reims. And then Peter Collins, for different reasons, under personal pressures, to try and hang on to his lead in the race on the back of the Silverstone win. And he runs wide as a corner. And, of course, the way these things happen, he could have got away quite unscathed. But as it was, I'm afraid there was a tree in the way and he hit that and he was received fatal head injuries.
Go back to the actual battle that Brooks has with the Ferraris. It's interesting because he mentions in his Race of My Life that they were much stronger on the straights, whereas once the fuel's come out of his car, he's much more happy with the handling in the corners, and that's where he makes the difference. So maybe Kev, you could just explain sort of how he ends up in first place, having charged back towards them.
Well, I think a little bit like Fangio the year before, I don't think it took him too long to find a way through. I think Ferrari traditionally did have a, you know, Enzo Ferrari was a big engine man. You know, it took him some time to be persuaded that it should go behind the driver. So it was engine before chassis. So Ferrari's quite often had the most powerful engine or one of the most powerful. I think by then the van wall was an equal package.
It wasn't as easy as it had been for Fangio to see off the Ferraris the previous year, because I'll just quote, if I may, from the Cyril Posthumus book, former deputy editor of Autosport. And the way it reads is this. On lap 8, the crowd roared, for the van wall had lapped in 9 minutes 10 seconds, was right on the Ferrari's tails. He passed them briefly on the twisty parts of the ring where the van wall excelled, but was repassed on the straight where the Ferraris were quicker. Lap 9, another was a lap later, and the trio slammed through the Start und Ziel area almost as one, Brooks nosing Hawthorn out of the north curve as they vanished from sight. Lap 10, and Collins led, and Brooks and Hawthorn were side by side. Then, bursting out of the south curve, Brooks passed Hawthorn, and on the north curve he took Collins too, and with several twisty miles ahead, he now began to pull away. So it wasn't a work of a moment in this year, in 1958, for Tony Brooks to see off the Ferraris. And I think, again, Mike Hawthorn responded initially, but of course it didn't last long, because he then was running behind his mate, Peter Collins, when Collins crashed. And so poor old Mike was there wondering what on earth had happened to Peter Collins, how was he, and also having to drive a motor race.
Absolutely. And Brooks says in his Race of My Life that he was ahead at the time and didn't see what had happened. He thought that the car itself had expired. So he's not aware of what's happened to Collins until well after the race. I do find it really interesting reading back through Brooks's words, because as you say, Kev, he's obviously gone away and spent a lot of time, you know, looking up things to pick things for his Race of My Life. And he says, you know, there's some uncanny similarities to the 1957 German Grand Prix. But in the end, he says the race was a bit of a damp squib after he's got to the front, in contrast to the dramatic finish that Fangio had the year before. But I think, you know, that's understandable given what has happened in the background that he doesn't know.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think probably just to pick up on Ian's Ian's point there as well, that it's, do you think it's fair to say, Ian, that the van wall and the Ferrari at that point are probably more evenly matched than the Maserati and the Ferrari had been the year before?
No, because I reckon those Lancia Ferraris, or the Ferrari that evolved from the Lancia, were very competitive cars. And the 250F was a very competitive car, driven by Jean Barry as well as by Fangio. And I think they're all pretty evenly matched. I mean, my memory going back, we'll talk about perhaps on another occasion, the European Grand Prix at Aintree, the van wall, except driven by Stirling Moss, the Ferrari and the Maserati were all pretty evenly matched cars with different characteristics, meaning that on different parts of each circuit. And of course, the circuits weren't all out of one formula in those days. They were very, very different. So cars went better at one than another. I mean, you'd never expect to see a 250F Maserati being driven quite in the elsewhere than at Rouen by Fangio. Those fabulous photographs of him coming down through the curves at Rouen. That was a Maserati at its very best. You wouldn't see a Van Wall driven like that.
No, I remember Stirling Moss said before that the Van Wall was harder to drive than the 250F, not as satisfying, but obviously was a very quick car. I think the 58 season is actually a really fascinating one because, as you say, it's so even and you've got the rise of Cooper at the same time as well. So 58's, and of course, it's the first year of the Constructors' Championship as well. So it's quite a, I think it's quite a watershed season for Formula One.
Indeed. And of course, in this race, so if I can jump ahead to the end of this race, yes, Tony Brooks won it, but finishing in second place was a Cooper, driven by the then number one works driver for Cooper, not Jack Brabham, no, Roy Salvadori. And Roy is always accused of being, unfairly, of being an airfield racer who went very well on the flat circuits and the airfields of the UK, but not well elsewhere. Well, he did win Le Mans, and he did have a fantastic drive to second place in the German Grand Prix in 1958, and finished, I think I might say, fourth in the World Championship that year. So a driver who's, I think, as underrated as Tony Brooks probably is.
Yeah, that's probably fair. Yeah, Roy Salvadori is someone that tends to get a little bit overlooked because he was a little bit before that generation of the British drivers we're talking about there. They came on sort of slightly later. Roy was almost more established, wasn't he, a little bit?
Yeah, he was older than, but I don't think, I mean, he began racing just after the war, but which is therefore slightly before Stirling Moss, and he was older than Stirling Moss, but I still think he was never bracketed with the others because he didn't actually win a Grand Prix. So he doesn't get that sort of elevation. But he was still, as I say, second place in the German Grand Prix to Tony Brooks. It was a mighty performance in the little Cooper.
Well, and Aston Martin saw fit to put him with Moss in the title decider in 59 at Goodwood, didn't they? So that's effectively their two lead drivers in the same car. I think that's probably fair to say, isn't it?
Yeah, my memory of that, I've got the programme stored away somewhere, but I'm pretty sure that he was, Stirling Moss was originally entered to share with Jack Fairman. And there was a big cheer went up when it was announced over the PA in fact, it was going to be Roy Salvadori sharing with Stirling Moss. But this was on race morning. It wasn't going to be out of the programme because nobody really rated Jack Fairman.
Well, Jack Fairman, most famous for hauling the Aston Martin out of the ditch he'd driven into at the 59 Nürburgring 1000 kilometres. But we've gone a bit off piste ourselves here.
Well, talking about the German Grand Prix, I mean, I think Roy Salvadori is highly relevant to the German Grand Prix, but he came in at the end, if you like, after the battle between the Van Walls and the Ferraris had kind of fizzled out and Tony Brooks was dominant for the last part of it.
I do. I think you can be very much allowed that tangent. This is very, very, very interesting and good to get that in. But I think let's end this section of the podcast here. I'll go back to Tony Brooks' words from Race of My Life, and then we'll get into perhaps some other choices that he could have picked from his career. So this is Tony Brooks. The fact that there was no room for error is another reason why it was so satisfying to do well at the ring. That was GP racing at the time, and it just isn't the same sport today, which is just as well, for the driver death rate in the 1950s represented a tragic waste of young lives. It's quite a poignant way he ends the Race of My Life there in that interview. And it almost seems trivial to go on to say, well, what other races could he have picked? But unfortunately, that is the way the podcast is arranged. So, Kev, why don't we start with you? What other options could Brooks have gone for his Race of My Life?
I'm going to go for another race at the Nürburgring because it involves an Aston Martin DBR1. He won the Aston Martin won three hat-trick of Nürburgring 1000 kilometre races, which was a major sports car race. It's all on a par with Grand Prix of the day, really. And the Aston Martins during the 50s were usually outgunned in terms of power by, well, pretty much all the other big manufacturers, Ferrari, Maserati, Mercedes, but did normally have a good handling car. Brooks managed to win the first of the DBR1's hat-tricks there with Noel Cunningham Reid as his co-driver. And I've always thought that was probably one of those races that sort of slightly lives under the radar. these days, although I suspect that it didn't at the time, Ian.
No, absolutely not, because it was the first win by Aston Martin in a high-profile World Championship sports car race, although the DB3S had won the TT at Dundrod a few years earlier. But this was a major win by Aston Martin, and it attracted a lot of publicity. Aston had, with their slightly smaller engine cars, 3 litres than the Jaguars had been at 3.4. Aston had struggled. They'd come very close to winning Le Mans a year earlier with the DB3S, with Stirling Moss and Peter Collins sharing the car. But yeah, it was a major event and a great triumph. Well, I know, Kevin, you think this too. It's a great-looking car, the DBR1, isn't it? It's just a perfect-looking racing car.
Yes, well, I'm currently, for a different Autosport series, I'm currently putting together the top 10 best-looking Le Mans cars, and I'm going to suggest the DBR1 should be somewhere on that list. But, yeah, I think it's probably worth making the point with Brooks that he seemed to excel on some of the really great circuits. You know, he was fantastic at Spa, fantastic at Nürburgring, and that's another example of it, really. And the year before, obviously, his Grand Prix win that we were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Brooks was an artist. I mean, he deliberately chose for his autobiography Poetry in Motion. I mean, he really liked the whole, enjoys the whole artistic side of being a racing driver. And he could develop his artistry, let it all come out. On Spa, he won at Nürburgring, and those kind of circuits. I mean, they were tailor-made for him. Not physically terribly strong, but had great endurance, but he wasn't terribly strong, which didn't matter quite so much in the way. I don't think he would have survived in I mean, put Tony Brooks and Alan Jones alongside. And their physiques are very, very different. But in the days of Alan's time in Formula One, you had to have a lot of muscle power.
What about putting forward almost an anomaly in the history of the F1 World Championship, which is Brooks's win at the 1959 German Grand Prix at Avis, because it's the victory is decided by heats. It's an aggregate scoring. You know, perhaps that takes away some of the drama and the excitement of a full blown Grand Prix, say at the Nürburgring, as we've discussed. But it's just fascinating that he has that almost record, really, when you think about just the World Championship. Anyway.
Yes, although am I not right that the Japanese Grand Prix in 1994 was a two-part race?
I think there have been several races that have been decided on aggregate as a result of a race stoppage. I can't think of any others that were, yeah, just scheduled as being two heats. I mean, I don't know why that was actually. I mean, Avis was it was basically motorway. Lanes of motorways joined at one end by hairpin, at the other side by a frankly terrifying looking banking. So it was a flat out blast for most of the route. So you needed a big powerful engine. I don't think it's a coincidence that Ferrari finished first, second, and third. Tony Brooks was the lead driver in 1959 at Ferrari with the likes of Phil Hill in the team. I think you would say Tony was the big one.
So it was reckoned that the cars would fall apart and therefore they needed to be screwed together again. The Ferraris wouldn't fall apart, they'd stay in one piece. But the Coopers and the Lotuses and the BRMs would need to be resuscitated before they could take part in the rest of the race. So I can't remember what the politics were behind the decision to run it at Arvus rather than Nürburgring. But I think some German motor racing politics came into play.
Well, I mean, I think if we're looking at 59 races, Alex, I'd have jotted down the French Grand Prix, which I don't think would be up into. It's not a heroic performance in the same way, but as the Nürburgring, but it's just somebody completely in control of the race. It was very hot. The track started to break up, and various people got hit in the face by the stones. And there was quite a big battle behind him. I think he probably did have the best car for that day, but he used it in a way that the great drivers do, which was to make it all look very easy. And he won the race. I think he won the race pretty comfortably. He won by half a minute at the end from Phil Hill, sort of future world champion in another Ferrari. And actually, I think it'd be interesting to see what Ian thinks about this. I think Brooks is perhaps a little unfortunate not to be world champion in 1959. You know, Brooks, Moss and Jack Brabham could all, I think, probably claim to have a stake on that. And I think a key moment for Brooks was at the Italian Grand Prix, which is a track that the Ferrari should have been good at. Obviously, he had the up-and-coming Cooper Climax, rear engine revolution, Jack Brabham, not quite as quick as Stirling Moss, but finished more of the races. And I think that probably Monza would have been a good race for Brooks in that with a couple of rounds to go. He qualified within a tenth of Moss. The front row was the three championship protagonists, if you like, but the car failed him. I think he had clutch failure basically off the line. And that put him on the back foot going into the season finale. But I don't know whether you think that Moss was more robbed of 59 or Brooks, really.
For different reasons, they were both robbed, but you can't have three world champions. I mean, Jack Brabham deserved his success, but of course Stirling Moss has played with a fragile gearbox. And as you've just described, Tony was thwarted in the Italian Grand Prix, which he should have won. And also he was thwarted by the fact there was no Belgian Grand Prix that year, which is one of his favourite circuits. That was a circuit where he reckoned the Ferraris would have the advantage. And then at Sebring for the American Grand Prix, of course, he gets thwarted by Harry Schell initially, who cheated and got himself onto the front row of the grid where Tony should have been. And then in the race, he gets hit in the rear by his teammate, Von Trips, and comes into the pits at the end of the first lap to check there's no damage. And it's one of his great drives, actually, his recovery drive to get back into third place. But I'm pretty sure that had he not made that pit stop, and the reasons he made it, we can talk about it in a moment, had he not made that pit stop, he probably would have won the race and won the world championship. So he came as close as Stirling Moss, really, to winning the championship that year.
Mm.
And the reason he stopped is because he's a very honest chap, Tony Brook. He confessed that he should never have tried to carry on driving the BRM in the 1956 Grand Prix, and that caused his huge accident coming out of Abbey, and the car crashed in flames. He got out with a broken jaw. As Tony always says, the car vented itself a favour by burning itself to cinders. Although, said effect, it's the best thing it could have done. He hated the car, and despite that, still went back to drive for BRM in his last year, 1961. And again, was disappointed with the way that BRM behaved. But that was the other big accident of his life was at Le Mans in 1957, when the car stuck in gear and he was trying to knock it out of gear and missed his breaking point for Tête Rouge or Mulsanne, and the car turned over and he got quite badly hurt.
I was going to suggest that was maybe the other reason, because he was still fiddling with the gear lever, wasn't he, as the breaking point sailed past.
The race of his life as an alternative is the Syracuse Grand Prix, 1955, in the Connaught. He'd never driven a Formula One car before. But it's a bit like, it's not quite the same, but different times these days. It's a bit like George Russell winning a Grand Prix in a Williams. I mean, it was perhaps even less likely because George has got lots of experience with these cars, but Tony had not driven a Formula One car before going down to Syracuse. He'd not been to Syracuse before. He hired a scooter, a Vespa, and learnt the circuit that way. And Syracuse wasn't a straightforward oval or anything simple like that. It was a complicated circuit. He was up against the Full Works Maserati team. Took pole position, another classic Tony, starting off gently, took the lead after a lap or so, and just disappeared into the distance. Much to the disgust of all the tifosi who were there cheering on the Maseratis that were getting nowhere compared with the, and that was just an extraordinary performance. And on his way out there and on his way back, he was doing his revision for his dental exams at Manchester University.
Yeah, I did quite a bit of research on this race for the non-championship F1 races special we did in Motorsport magazine a month or two ago. And actually qualified third. He did go on to pole initially, but they were trying to limit the engine mileage on the Connaught because they were very, to continue with your Williams analogy, they were cash strapped. So Luigi Musso and Luigi Villoresi did out qualify him in the end. And he also made a very tentative start initially because he'd never done a start before. And then he just gradually got wound up. I think he went past Villoresi quite quickly and then had a bit of a fight with Musso where he realised quite quickly that Musso was just going to chuck it down the inside at the hairpin every time. So he let him do it, sail wide and out accelerating on the exit until basically Maserati's brakes were finished. And then he just drove off into the distance. And doing so under the rev limit that Connaught, quite a tight rev limit that Connaught were placed on him. So, yeah, very classy, thoughtful performance for someone, as you say, not really, you know, with no F1 experience at all, with plenty of other things on his mind. And it was quite a watershed moment for British motorsport as well, because although it wasn't a world championship race, it was the first time a British-built car had been able to see off the you know, sort of erstwhile Italian benchmarks.
Yeah, and he's although we're saying it's his first Formula One race, he had done about five, I think, Formula Two races in an A-type Connaught. So he had very limited single-seater experience, let alone no Formula One experience. It was a measure of just how talented he was. And, of course, Stirling Moss wasn't who said that if he had to run his own racing team, the two people he'd have in it would be Tony Brooks and Jim Clark.
Yes, well, that says a lot, doesn't it? Just an interesting sort of sub-note on that is that apparently the Italian organisers couldn't really believe the pace of the Connaught, so insisted that the engine, it's just an alter engine, I think, it wasn't anything particularly up against the Italian cars, Maserati in particular, and Stripton obviously found nothing, you know, nothing amiss, and you know, got to keep the win, and I think probably earned a lot of people's respect on that day.
That's absolutely right. And it didn't receive huge amounts of publicity outside. I don't know how much space off the top of my head, I can't remember, Autosport gave to the race. But because it was happening out of season almost in October down in southern Italy, it didn't get that much coverage. But I think that the people, the Brits who flew out there, all under an early John Webb of Motorcycle Development's fame, John Webb idea of under Webb Air, and there was one sort of charter flight that flew in a Dakota DC-3 or something pretty venerable down from the UK to Sicily to watch the race. So a few people did get there, but not that many. It didn't get that much coverage.
As has sometimes happened in those days, All Sports Report wasn't ready in time for that week's issue, but it did have the cover. And I think a four-page report in the following, you know, the week after, if that makes sense. So it was made a big deal of eventually once the report had been filed and flown back and all the rest of it.
So that is, I would offer as a candidate for the race of his life. If you don't go for the Nürburgring, which of course was tinged with the sadness, which he wouldn't have known on the podium, but would have known pretty soon afterwards about Peter Collins.
Absolutely. And I think now is a good point. Sally, I mean, I could listen to you guys talking about all this stuff for many, many hours, but we must bring this podcast to a close. So I'm gonna do my ridiculous, frankly, judgment on whether these great drivers, whether they're allowed to keep the picks that they've had for their race in my life. And I'm gonna definitely let Brooks have I'm definitely gonna let Brooks have the 1958 German Grand Prix because of the way, having read through the feature, he's clearly dedicated time to researching what happened the year before, looking up his own race. It's really in depth, it's really in detail, and I very much appreciate that. First of all, when it came out in the magazine in 1993, and again, it's given us some great things to talk about today.
And I think I would agree with Ian that I would have put the Syracuse race forward, but I think ultimately the opposition that Brooks has at the 58 German Grand Prix is probably overall stronger. And of course it is at the Nürburgring, which, as we've said before, you've got to get some bonus points for it just being at that awesome track. So yeah, I think it's a pretty solid choice, I think.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Ian, and thank you very much, Kev, for joining me today, and thank you guys for listening. Do let us know what you thought of the podcast. Get in touch with us on social media using our handle @autosports, and do check out all of Tony Brooks's words on this race on autosport.com. Thank you very much.